This deep diet is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. So check them out at certfuel.com.
Yeah, they are a great resource if you're prepping for the exam.
Definitely. Okay, so imagine you hand over like 100 grand to buy a piece of a revolutionary, cutting-edge biotech startup.
Sounds risky, but okay, I'm with you.
Right. It's super risky, but you wire the money, you get the shares, and you are officially an owner.
Congratulations.
Thank you. But then you show up to the annual meeting to vote on where the company's profits should go, and a guy in a tailored suit who bought his shares in a private backroom deal stands up, legally drowns out your voice completely, and dictates exactly what happens to your money.
Yeah, that is a rude awakening for a lot of retail investors.
It really is. So today, we are tearing apart the illusion of shareholder democracy. Because if you are studying for the Series 65, you really don't need another dry lecture listing out bullet points to memorize.
No, you need to understand how the machine actually works.
Exactly. Our mission for this deep dive is to completely dismantle and rebuild your understanding of equity characteristics. We are going to look under the hood of the financial system to figure out exactly why these corporate rules exist, who they actually protect, and how the SEC functions as a referee.
And just to kind of give you the geographical map of where we are in the material, our last discussion was all about the types of equity.
Right, like common stock, preferred stock, ADRs, that sort of thing.
Exactly. We established what those vehicles are, but today we are putting you in the driver's seat.
Yeah.
Today is about the rights and the restrictions of that ownership.
Yeah, like when that digital entry is just sitting there in your brokerage account, what actual enforceable legal power does it give you?
Which is the core of what the exam is going to test you on.
Right. And to anchor this in reality, because, corporate finance law can be notoriously dense.
It's incredibly dry if you just read it from a textbook.
Totally. So we are going to follow the life cycle of a very specific, high-stakes, fictional company. We aren't doing the standard lemonade stand analogy today.
No, we need higher stakes.
Yeah, we are looking at Frank's Ferret Farm Incorporated, or as they rebranded for their IPO, Ferrigen.
Ferrigen, I love it.
Right. Ferrigen is a multi-million dollar biotech startup that genetically engineers bespoke ferrets capable of sniffing out microscopic early stage pancreatic tumors.
So the stakes are massive and the capital requirements are just astronomical.
Exactly. And navigating this crazy corporate labyrinth are our three recurring players. First, we have Frank, the founder.
Of course, the guy who started it all.
Yeah, Frank is the brilliant, slightly erratic, highly ambitious CEO who started Ferrigen in his garage. Second, we have Minority Mary.
She's our retail investor, right?
Exactly. She is our retail investor hero. She read about the tumor-sniffing ferrets, believed in the mission, and bought a tiny sliver of the company on the open market. She just wants her fair share of the upside.
Which is what we all want.
Right. And sitting across the table from Mary is corporate Carl. Carl is a massive venture capital insider.
The guy in the tailored suit from your intro.
That's him. He sits on the board of directors. He bought his shares before the company ever went public, and he operates entirely in those mahogany boardrooms where the real decisions are made.
So we have Frank, Mary, and Carl, the founder, the retail investor, and the insider.
Exactly. So before Frank can start hiring geneticists or building these advanced ferret containment facilities, we have to establish the ground rules of what it means to actually own a piece of Ferrigen. What are the rules of the pie?
And specifically, what legal rights does Minority Mary hold in her hands as a common stockholder?
Right. And I think the absolute bedrock concept of common stock is that it represents a residual claim on the corporation.
A residual claim. You have to know that term for the exam.
Yeah, and I want to push on that word residual for a second because, it sounds like a passing accounting term, but it's actually the defining characteristic of capitalism.
It really is. Residual basically means what is left over.
Right. When you buy common stock, you are not buying a guaranteed payout. You're buying the right to the ultimate leftovers.
Think of the capital structure of a company like the geological layers of a mountain.
Okay, I like that visual.
Right. So at the very bottom, forming the bedrock, you have the secured creditors. Those are the banks that hold the mortgage on the laboratory.
They are super safe.
Exactly. Above them, you have the bondholders. Above them, the preferred stockholders. And sitting at the absolute peak, totally exposed to all the wind and the weather, are the common stockholders like Mary.
So if it rains gold, it hits the peak first. Mary gets the infinite upside of the company's growth.
Right. But if a financial earthquake hits and the mountain starts to crumble, the peak collapses first. The bedrock is protected, but Mary takes the hit.
So being a residual owner means you have the maximum potential for wealth creation, but you absorb the maximum initial impact of failure.
That is exactly it. And because Mary is carrying that ultimate residual risk, corporate law grants her a specific set of defensive weapons.
Right. And the most prominent one is the right to vote. She gets a say in the direction of the company.
She does. But we need to draw a very hard line right here, because the exam is going to test exactly where Mary's power stops.
Oh, totally. So Mary gets to vote on the election of the board of directors.
Sure.
If Frank decides he wants to merge Ferrigen with a massive pharmaceutical conglomerate, Mary gets to vote on that.
Correct.
If they want to authorize more shares or change the fundamental corporate charter, Mary votes.
All true. But here is the massive roadblock. Shareholders do not vote on dividends.
Let's pause and really look at that, because I have a major problem with that concept on its face.
Most people do when they first learn it.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, if I own the company and the company makes $100 million in profit, why doesn't my vote dictate whether I get a cut of my own profits? Why is that decision just completely isolated from the owners?
It traces back to the fundamental friction between capital allocation and just, you know, short-term human greed.
Fair point.
If shareholders could vote on dividends, human nature dictates that they would vote to drain the company's bank accounts every single quarter to get cash in their pockets today.
Yeah, they'd just bleed the company dry.
Exactly. There would be no money left to build a new laboratory or hire a new chief scientist or survive an economic downturn.
So corporate law deliberately removes that temptation from the shareholders. The declaration of a dividend is the sole exclusive jurisdiction of the board of directors.
Right. The board is legally bound by a fiduciary duty to look out for the long-term survival of the corporation itself.
So Mary can stand up at the annual meeting and scream until she is blue in the face demanding a cash payout, but she has absolutely no standing right to force one.
None at all. The board holds all the cards there.
Okay, so Mary can't vote on the cash, but she can vote on who sits on that board. She can try to elect directors who are friendly to her interests.
And this brings us to a massive, highly testable showdown: the mechanics of corporate voting.
Yes, the exam is going to require you to understand the exact difference between statutory voting and cumulative voting.
Let's look at why statutory voting is the default, and frankly, why it can be incredibly frustrating for someone like Mary.
Yeah, under statutory voting, the mechanism is completely linear. It's just one share equals one vote per open director seat.
So let's put our characters in the boardroom. Say Ferrigen has three open seats on its board of directors: seat A, seat B, and seat C.
Okay, and Minority Mary owns 100 shares. Corporate Carl owns 1,000 shares.
Under the statutory method, they run three completely isolated elections. It is a winner-take-all system for each individual seat.
So for seat A, Mary casts her 100 votes for a director who wants to focus on ferret health. Corporate Carl casts his 1,000 votes for a director who wants to slash research budgets and boost immediate profits.
Carl has 1,000, Mary has 100, Carl wins seat A.
And then they move to seat B. The exact same math happens. Carl wins.
Move to seat C. Carl wins again.
Because it is a linear seat-by-seat election, a shareholder with 51% of the voting power doesn't just win 51% of the representation. They win 100% of the board seats.
It completely shuts the minority out of the room.
It sounds like legalized oligarchy. Why does the system even exist?
Well, it exists because corporations prize singular direction. If every minority shareholder group could easily fracture the board and put their own single-issue activists in the boardroom, you'd have total gridlock.
Right. A company cannot function if its leadership is constantly at war with itself.
Exactly. Statutory voting guarantees that whoever holds the majority of the risk gets total control of the steering wheel. It heavily benefits the majority.
But sometimes investors look at that system and say, you know, I am not handing over my money unless I have a guaranteed voice in the room.
And that is exactly where cumulative voting comes in.
Yeah.
This is an alternative system designed explicitly to punch a hole in that monolithic majority control.
So how does cumulative voting rewrite the rules?
Instead of three separate elections, you take your number of shares and you multiply it by the number of open seats. This generates a massive combined pool of voting power that you can deploy however you want.
Oh, that changes everything. Let's run the Ferrigen math again. Mary has 100 shares. There are three open seats.
So 100 multiplied by 3 gives Mary a pool of 300 total votes.
And Corporate Carl has 1,000 shares. Multiplied by 3 seats, he has a pool of 3,000 total votes.
Carl still has 10 times the power. But the strategic landscape has completely changed.
Right, because Carl wants his three specific buddies to win all three seats. To do that, he has to spread his massive pool of votes across the three candidates.
Exactly. He gives 1,000 votes to candidate A, 1,000 to candidate B, and 1,000 to candidate C.
Mary looks at the board and realizes she cannot win a sweeping victory. But she doesn't need to. She just needs one voice in the room.
So what does she do?
She abandons seat B and seat C entirely. She takes all 300 of her accumulated votes and dumps them entirely onto her single favorite candidate for seat A.
And if Carl had slightly fewer shares, or if there were more seats open, Mary's concentrated block of 300 votes might easily overwhelm Carl's divided forces on that one specific seat.
I like to think of statutory voting like a series of three separate arm wrestling matches, or like a tug of war. Carl has 10 guys on his side of the rope. Mary has one. Carl's going to drag her into the mud three times in a row.
That's a great analogy. Cumulative voting says we aren't doing three matches. We are doing one giant match, and you can put all your strength on one knot on the rope.
Yeah, Mary still loses the overall war, but she successfully pulls one single director over the line.
The essential exam takeaway here is super clear. Statutory voting heavily protects and benefits the majority shareholder. Cumulative voting is a defensive mechanism that benefits the minority shareholder by allowing them to concentrate their voting power.
Okay, so keeping Mary's defensive mechanisms in mind, let's look at another existential threat to her ownership.
Dilution.
Yes, dilution. Let's say Ferrigen is doing incredibly well. The tumor-sniffing ferrets have a 99% accuracy rate. Frank, the founder, realizes they need to build a $50 million breeding facility in Switzerland. But to raise that kind of cash, the company can't just take out a bank loan. They need to issue brand new equity.
So Frank authorizes the creation of 10 million brand new shares of common stock, and he plans to sell them to massive institutional investors.
Now put yourself in Mary's shoes for a second. Before this happens, she owned, let's say, 10% of the entire company. She is a major player.
But if Frank suddenly prints 10 million brand new shares and sells them to strangers, the total pie just got massively larger. The number of slices exploded.
Right, but Mary still only holds her original number of shares, so her 10% ownership is going to instantly shrink to like 2%.
Her voting power is diluted. Her claim on future dividends is diluted.
Exactly. To prevent a founder from quietly diluting minority shareholders into oblivion, corporate charters often include anti-dilution provisions.
Right, and for the exam, you need to know these as preemptive rights.
Preemptive rights. Basically, this means that before Frank can sell a single newly minted share to the public, he must step up to the existing common stockholders and offer them the first bite at the apple.
He has to give them the opportunity to buy enough of the new stock to maintain their exact proportionate ownership.
But how does this actually work mechanically? I mean, does Frank just call Mary on her cell phone?
No. The company issues a very specific short-term financial instrument called a subscription right.
So these are actual tradable securities that get deposited directly into Mary's brokerage account.
Yes, exactly. A subscription right basically says because you are a loyal owner, you have the right to buy the new stock at a slight discount to the upcoming public offering price.
But you have to act fast, right?
Very fast. These instruments have a short lifespan, typically only 30 to 45 days.
So Mary now faces a choice. If she has the cash on hand, she can exercise her rights, buy the discounted shares, and fiercely protect her 10% ownership stake.
But what if Mary doesn't have the cash? What if all her money is tied up in other investments?
This is where the structure of a subscription right becomes brilliant, because the right gives you the ability to buy a stock at a discount to its actual market value. The piece of paper itself has intrinsic value.
It is worth money on its own.
Right. If Mary cannot afford to buy the shares, she doesn't just lose out. She can take those subscription rights and sell them on the secondary market to another investor.
Someone else will gladly pay Mary for the privilege of buying Ferrigen stock at a discount. So even if she gets diluted, she gets compensated for that dilution by selling her rights.
Okay, I want you to pause and think about this logically, because the exam is going to throw a curveball at you right here.
A huge crap.
So think about this. If Mary owned preferred stock in Ferrigen instead of common stock, would she still receive these preemptive subscription rights?
Take a second.
The answer is absolutely not. Preemptive rights are an exclusive privilege of the common stockholder.
Why is that? Go back to the foundation of what preferred stock is. Preferred stock acts much more like a bond. It has a fixed, stated dividend rate.
Right. A preferred stockholder generally does not get to vote, and they don't share in the exponential upside of the company's growth.
Because they are not participating in the voting control of the company, they don't need a mechanism to protect their proportionate voting control.
That makes total sense. The exam will frequently try to offer preemptive rights to a preferred shareholder in a multiple choice question. Do not take the bait.
Never take the bait.
Speaking of preferred stock, we need to address the darkest scenario in the corporate life cycle.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I'm going to make a sinking ship alarm noise. Ooh. What happens when the music stops?
Let's imagine a catastrophic failure. A rival biotech firm develops a tumor-sniffing golden retriever.
Oh no, people love golden retrievers.
The market for medical ferrets collapses overnight. Ferrigen's revenues hit zero. They burn through their cash. Frank, the founder, has to file for Chapter 7 bankruptcy liquidation.
The company is dead.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a bankruptcy court trustee steps in to sell off the microscopes, the lab equipment, the real estate, and empty the bank accounts.
There is a massive pile of cash on the table, but it is nowhere near enough to pay everyone back.
Who gets the lifeboats first?
The exam will require you to know the absolute, rigid hierarchy of the liquidation priority line. And it traces directly back to that geological mountain of capital structure we talked about earlier.
Right. First in line, standing at the very front with absolute priority, are the secured creditors.
These are the lenders whose debt is backed by a specific physical asset. If a major bank issued a mortgage to build the Swiss breeding facility and the company goes under, the bank gets to seize that specific facility, sell it, and make themselves whole before anyone else sees a dime.
Second in line are the unsecured creditors. This includes debenture holders.
Right. People who bought corporate bonds that were backed only by the full faith and credit of the company, not a specific building.
This layer also includes general creditors, like, I don't know, the contractor who was halfway through painting the lobby when the company went bankrupt, or unpaid taxes to the IRS.
Third in line, and this is a crucial distinction, are the subordinated debenture holders.
Let's stop here. Why on earth would someone willingly buy a subordinated bond? Why would you lend money to a company and explicitly agree in writing to stand further back in the priority line if things go wrong?
It is the universal trade-off of risk and reward. If Ferrigen already had a ton of debt and they needed more cash, traditional banks might refuse to lend to them.
So Ferrigen goes to high-risk debt investors and says, look, we know it's risky. If we go bankrupt, you agree to let the regular bondholders get paid before you. In exchange for you taking on that severe subordination risk, we will pay you a massive 12% interest rate instead of the standard 6%.
Exactly. Subordinated debt is high yield because it is highly vulnerable in a liquidation.
Okay, so the secured debt is paid. The unsecured debt is paid. The subordinated debt is paid. All the lenders are out of the room. Now we finally reach the actual owners of the equity.
Fourth in line are the preferred stockholders.
They are prioritized ahead of the common stock. They are entitled to receive their par value, the original stated value of their shares, returned to them.
And finally, fifth in line, standing dead last, holding an empty bucket, are the common stockholders.
They have that ultimate residual claim. They get whatever's left over, which, in a corporate liquidation, is almost universally zero.
There is a psychological trap the exam sets up regarding preferred stock in this scenario. Because preferred stock is technically senior to common stock, the test will try to trick you into classifying preferred stock as a safe or guaranteed investment.
It is absolutely not safe.
Look at the line again. Preferred stock might be ahead of common, but they are still standing behind every single piece of debt the company ever issued.
Yeah, even the incredibly risky, high-yield subordinated debentures rank legally ahead of the preferred stockholders. Being the senior equity simply means you are the tallest person in the deepest part of the valley. You're still completely submerged if the debt load is heavy enough.
But there is one massive saving grace for Mary as a common stockholder. It is the concept of limited liability.
Imagine if Ferrigen didn't just go bankrupt, but they actually caused $1 billion in environmental damage. And the creditors were hunting for cash. Because Mary is an owner, can the creditors come after her personal checking account?
Can they put a lien on her house or repossess her car to pay the company's debts?
No. In a modern corporation, the liability of both common and preferred stockholders is strictly limited to the amount of money they initially invested.
If Mary bought $5,000 worth of stock, the absolute worst case scenario is that the value of those shares drops to zero. And she loses her $5,000.
Her personal external assets are completely firewalled away from the corporation's failures.
All right. We've established the fundamental rights. voting dynamics, anti-dilution protections, and the grim reality of the liquidation line.
Now, we need to shift our focus away from Mary and look at the darker, more regulated side of the market. Let's look at Corporate Carl.
The VIP section.
Exactly. Mary bought her shares on the public stock exchange. She logged into an app, clicked a button, and bought fully registered, publicly vetted securities. She can log in tomorrow and sell them just as easily.
But Corporate Carl is a completely different animal.
Carl provided millions in venture capital to Frank the founder years before Farragin ever went public. He got his shares in a private, unregistered backroom transaction. He is a massive insider with a seat on the board of directors.
The Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, looks at someone like Carl and sees a massive potential threat to the integrity of the public markets.
If insiders with unregistered stock could just quietly dump their shares onto the public exchange whenever they wanted, the system would collapse.
So the SEC built a very specific cage for people like Carl. It is known as Rule 144.
Rule 144. To master this, you have to mentally separate the regulations into two distinct categories, the what and the who.
Let's start with the what. This is restricted stock.
Restricted stock is restricted purely because of what it is. These are securities that were acquired through an unregistered private sale from the issuer.
This includes Regulation D private placements, seed capital from angel investors, or compensation plans for executives before an IPO.
The philosophy here goes back to the Securities Act of 1933. The core mandate of the SEC is that the public must be provided with deep, accurate financial disclosures before they are asked to buy a stock.
Because restricted stock was minted in a private deal, it never went through that rigorous, expensive public registration process. It has never been vetted by the sunlight of public disclosure.
Therefore, the SEC strictly prohibits it from being casually dumped onto the public market.
That is the what. Now let's look at the who. This is control stock.
Control stock is restricted because of who holds it. The SEC defines a control person or an affiliate as an officer of the company, a director on the board, or any shareholder who owns 10% or more of the outstanding voting stock.
Corporate Carl is on the board of directors. He is an insider. Therefore, any stock he holds is subject to immense regulatory scrutiny.
And this leads us to one of the most brilliant, deceptive exam traps you will face.
Oh, this one gets so many people.
Think about this scenario. Corporate Carl decides he wants to increase his stake in Farragin. He doesn't go to Frank for a private deal. Instead, Carl logs into a standard retail brokerage account and buys 1,000 fully registered, totally normal shares on the open public market, exactly like Mary did.
Those shares are clean. They're registered.
Yep.
So Carl can just trade them freely, right?
Absolutely not. The moment those clean registered shares land in Corporate Carl's account, they instantly mutate into control stock.
Why? Because the SEC restriction follows the person, not the security.
Carl sits in the boardroom. He knows about the failed ferret experiments before the public does. He knows about the upcoming government contracts before they hit the news.
Because he possesses that profound information asymmetry, the SEC places volume limits and strict reporting rules on every single share he touches, regardless of how he originally acquired it.
So Carl is sitting on a mountain of unregistered, restricted stock from his early venture capital days. He is basically in shareholder jail. He is legally forbidden from selling those shares to the public.
How long is his sentence? How long must he wait before those unregistered shares can finally be sold into the public market?
The holding period under Rule 144 depends entirely on the public visibility of the company itself. There are two different clocks.
If Farragin is an SEC reporting company, the holding period is 6 months. If Farragin is a non-reporting company, the holding period is 12 months.
We need to understand the structural logic behind those two different timelines, or you will mix them up under the stress of the exam. Why does a reporting company get a shorter 6-month sentence?
An SEC reporting company is an entity that has already crossed the threshold into the public domain. They are legally required to file massive, detailed financial documents into the SEC's public database.
Right. They file the 10-K, which is the exhaustive annual report audited by independent accountants. They file the 10-Q, the quarterly financial update. They file the 8-K anytime a major material event happens.
Because all of this verified data is pumping into the ecosystem, the market is highly efficient. Wall Street analysts are reading those 10-Ks. Institutional algorithms are digesting the 10-Qs.
The market already has a profoundly accurate, independently verified understanding of what Farragin is actually worth. Because the public is already highly informed, the SEC feels comfortable letting the insider unlock their unregistered shares after just 6 months.
But a non-reporting company is a financial black box. They are not filing 10Ks. They are not filing 10Qs.
The public has absolutely zero verified insight into whether the company is generating massive cash flow or secretly spiraling into bankruptcy.
So for a non-reporting company, the SEC effectively says, look, there is no sunlight here. We need to lock these insider shares away for a much longer time to allow the open market to independently ascertain the true value of this company without relying on SEC filings.
So they double the holding period to a full 12 months. The core philosophy is the higher the level of public disclosure, the shorter the required holding period.
Let's advance the timeline. Farragin is a reporting company, so Carl has patiently served his six-month holding period. The clock strikes midnight. His restriction is lifted.
Carl decides he wants to cash out. He wants to sell his entire 15% ownership stake in Farragin on a Tuesday morning and go buy an island in the Mediterranean. Can he do it?
No. He is slammed into a brick wall known as volume limitations.
Even after the holding period expires, because Carl is an affiliate, an insider, he is never allowed to just freely dump his massive holdings.
Let's look at the mechanics of why the SEC enforces this. If a major insider unloads 15% of a company's outstanding equity onto the market in a single morning, two catastrophic things happen.
First, the sheer physics of supply and demand will shatter the stock price. The market cannot absorb that much supply at once without the price plummeting.
Second, it sends a terrifying psychological signal. If the board of directors is aggressively bailing out of the stock, the retail market is going to assume the company's imploding. It causes a panic cascade.
More legally speaking, the SEC views this through the lens of registration. If Carl sells 15% of the company, he isn't just executing a trade. He is effectively acting as his own unregistered underwriter, conducting a massive public distribution of securities without giving the public a prospectus.
To prevent this, the SEC enforces a very strict mathematical speed limit on Carl.
The Rule 144 volume limit states that in any rolling 90-day window, an affiliate can sell the greater of two specific benchmarks. Benchmark 1 is 1% of the total outstanding shares of the company. Benchmark 2 is the average weekly trading volume of the stock over the previous 4 months.
Carl has to do this math before he executes a trade. Let's say Farragin has 100 million shares outstanding. 1% of that is 1 million shares.
Then he looks at the trading volume for the last 4 weeks, and the average comes out to 800,000 shares a week. Carl is allowed to sell the greater of those two numbers.
So his absolute cap, his maximum speed limit for the next 90 days, is 1 million shares.
If he wants to sell more, he either has to wait for a new 90-day window to open, or the company has to do a formal, expensive, registered secondary offering with the SEC.
Now, I want you to apply this logic to our retail investor.
Okay, listener, here is a question for you. Let's imagine Minority Mary, our non-affiliate, somehow acquired a block of unregistered, restricted shares through a weird early compensation deal. She holds those restricted shares for the required 6 months. When Mary's six-month holding period is up, does she have to calculate the 1% volume limit? Does the speed limit apply to her?
Think about it.
The answer is absolutely not. This is a phenomenal exam question. Non-affiliates, regular people who do not have insider control or access to non-public information, can sell freely with zero volume limitations the exact second their holding period expires.
The SEC is not worried about Mary crashing the market or manipulating the public. Volume limits are a permanent leash placed exclusively on the insiders.
And because Carl is on that leash, he cannot move in the shadows. He is forced to leave a massive paper trail. The exam tests your knowledge of four specific SEC insider reporting documents: Form 144, Form 3, Form 4, and Form 5.
Let's hit Form 144 first, because it ties directly into the volume limits we just discussed. If an insider intends to sell a significant amount of stock, specifically more than 5,000 shares, or an aggregate dollar amount greater than $50,000 in a 90-day window, they must file Form 144.
And the timing is critical. This form must be filed concurrently with the placement of the sell order. It is an immediate flare sent up to the SEC saying, I am an insider and I am actively liquidating a large position right now.
Then we have the broader insider tracking forms. Form 3 is the initial statement of beneficial ownership.
When a person is newly elected to the board of directors, or when a massive institution crosses that 10% ownership threshold to become an affiliate, they have to file Form 3. It essentially acts as the birth certificate of an insider. It says, hello, SEC, I have entered the restricted tier.
Form 5 is at the complete opposite end of the urgency spectrum. It is an annual catch-all filing used to report certain exempt transactions that occurred over the past year, like receiving a stock gift.
It is important for compliance, but rarely the focal point of intense exam questioning. Which brings us to the heavyweight champion of SEC paperwork traps, Form 4.
Form 4 is used to report any changes in an insider's ownership position. If Carl buys more shares, or if Carl sells shares, he must file Form 4.
The exam trap here is all about the trigger threshold and the timing. Historically, decades ago, the reporting rules were incredibly lax. Insiders had until the 10th day of the following month to report their trades to the SEC.
So if an executive dumped all his stock on January 1st, the public wouldn't find out about it until February 10th. This created massive information asymmetry.
During corporate scandals like Enron, executives were quietly dumping their shares while simultaneously locking employees out of their retirement accounts and telling the public the company was fine.
In response to that, Congress passed the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, and they fundamentally weaponized Form 4.
Today, the rule is brutal and absolute. Form 4 must be filed with the SEC within exactly 2 business days of the transaction. 2 business days. The turnaround is incredibly fast.
And more importantly, there is no size threshold. Do not confuse Form 4 with the 5,000 share limit of Form 144.
If corporate Carl logs into his account and buys exactly 1 single share of Farragin stock, his ownership has changed. The 2-day clock immediately starts ticking. 1 share equals 2 days.
If you remember the history of why that rule exists, you will never miss a Form 4 question.
All right, let's step out of the regulatory cage and get back to the actual economics of owning a successful company. Let's transition to Section 3, dividends. Getting paid.
The fun part.
Yeah. The narrative here is that Farragin has hit its stride. The tumor-sniffing ferrets have FDA approval. The Swiss facility is operational. The company is generating massive, predictable cash flow, and they have built up a huge reservoir of retained earnings.
The board of directors decides it is time to reward the loyal shareholders who stomached the early volatility.
We need to break down the 3 distinct types of dividends a company can issue, and specifically, the psychological and tax impacts of each. The first, and overwhelmingly most common, is the cash dividend.
The mechanics here are simple. The company literally transfers cash from its corporate treasury directly into Mary's brokerage account for every share she owns.
The corporate bank account goes down, Mary's bank account goes up. From a tax perspective, cash dividends are an immediate taxable event in the year they are received. The IRS views it as realized income.
However, the rate at which they are taxed depends on a specific holding period.
If Mary has held the stock for more than 60 days during a specific 121-day window surrounding the dividend and is issued by a U.S. corporation, the IRS classifies it as a qualified dividend.
This is a massive benefit because qualified dividends are taxed at the highly favorable long-term capital gains rates, typically 15% for most investors.
What if she just bought the stock yesterday for a quick flip? She fails that holding period. It becomes an ordinary dividend and she gets hammered at her normal higher marginal income tax bracket.
The second type is the property dividend. This is incredibly rare in the modern market, but highly testable simply because it is weird.
Very weird. Instead of cash, the company distributes a physical asset or a product. Imagine if Frank decided to literally ship a live, genetically engineered ferret to every single shareholder.
Or, more realistically, a subsidiary company stock.
The key exam point for a property dividend is the tax basis. If you receive a property dividend, it is taxable as income based entirely on the fair market value of the asset on the day it is distributed. The IRS will value that ferret and tax you on it.
But the third type of dividend is where the most dangerous exam traps lie, the stock dividend.
This requires a complete mental shift because the terminology itself is deeply misleading. It sounds like you were getting a bonus. Let's say Frank announces a massive 25% stock dividend.
Let's run the math on Mary's account. Mary currently owns 100 shares of Farragin, and the stock is trading aggressively at $100 a share. Her total portfolio value is $10,000.
Frank issues the 25% stock dividend. The clearinghouse deposits 25 brand new shares into Mary's account. She logs in and sees she now has 125 shares. Human psychology immediately assumes she just got 25% richer.
But we have to look at the macroeconomic reality of what just happened. The best way to understand a stock dividend is the pizza analogy.
Oh, I love the pizza analogy. Think of it like this. You have a large pizza cut into 8 slices. The company announces a stock dividend, which is basically them taking a pizza cutter and cutting your exact same pizza into 10 slices instead of 8.
Do you have more pizza?
No, you just have more smaller slices. Or to use another analogy, imagine a tiny island nation that has exactly 100 bars of gold sitting in a vault, and they have exactly 100 paper dollar bills in circulation. Each paper dollar represents exactly one bar of gold.
If the government suddenly fires up the printing press and prints 25 brand new dollar bills and hands them out to the citizens, did the island just create more wealth?
No. There are still exactly 100 bars of gold in the vault. The fundamental value of the nation hasn't changed by a single ounce. But because there are now 125 paper bills chasing the exact same amount of gold, the purchasing power of every individual bill is instantly diluted.
Each bill is now worth less than a full bar of gold. That is exactly what a stock dividend does to corporate equity.
Farragin didn't magically create new laboratories or invent new patents overnight. The underlying value of the company is exactly the same. They simply printed more paper claims on that existing value.
So when Mary receives her 25 new shares, the open market instantly and mathematically adjusts the share price downward to reflect that dilution. She has 125 shares. But the market price drops from $100 down to exactly $80 a share.
Let's do the new math. 125 shares multiplied by $80 a share equals exactly $10,000. Her total net worth didn't change by a single penny. She has more pieces of paper, but each piece is worth proportionally less.
Because her total wealth did not increase, there's a profound tax implication here. Stock dividends are not a taxable event when they are received.
The IRS is incredibly ruthless, but they are logical. They look at Mary's account and say, you started the day with $10,000. You ended the day with $10,000. You didn't realize any economic gain, so we cannot tax you today.
Instead, a stock dividend acts as an accounting mechanism. It simply adjusts your cost basis per share downward.
Mary originally paid $100 per share. For future tax purposes, her new cost basis is adjusted down to $80 per share. She will only owe taxes down the road if she eventually decides to sell those 125 shares for a profit.
So lock this contrast into your brain. Cash dividends are taxed immediately. Stock dividends are a non-taxable event that merely lowers your per-share cost basis.
Now let's talk about the actual plumbing of the financial system. Let's talk about when a dividend is actually paid out and who gets to claim it.
There are four key dates you must memorize regarding the dividend timeline. The classic industry acronym is DERP. DERP.
The D is the declaration date. This is the day the board of directors officially votes and announces, we are going to pay a $2 cash dividend. Once declared, it becomes a legal liability of the corporation.
We will skip E for a moment and jump to R. The R is the record date.
This is the exact day the company takes a snapshot of its official shareholder ledger. If your legal name is printed on the ledger at 4 BOPM on the record date, the company will mail the dividend check to your house. If your name is not on the ledger, you get nothing.
The P is the payable date. This is simply the future date when the cash actually leaves the corporate bank account and hits the clearinghouses.
But the most highly tested, deeply mechanical concept is the E, the ex-dividend date.
To understand the ex-dividend date, we have to pull back the curtain and look at how stock trades actually settle.
When you open your phone and hit buy on a stock, your app immediately flashes green. It feels instantaneous. But behind the scenes, you are not instantly the legal registered owner of that stock.
Your broker has to send the order to an exchange. It has to match with the seller, and then the transaction goes to a massive clearinghouse called the DTCC, the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation.
They handle billions of shares a day, netting out the cash transfers and updating the master ledgers. That physical plumbing takes time.
Decades ago, it took 5 full business days for a trade to settle. Then technology improved, and it dropped to T+3. For a long time, it was T+2.
But you must know the current modern rule. In May of 2024, the SEC fundamentally upgraded the speed of the market. We now operate on T+1 settlement, trade date plus one business day.
If you buy a stock on Monday, the money physically moves and the official ledger is updated on Tuesday.
This T+1 settlement timeline creates a fascinating logistical problem around dividends. Let's put Mary in a dramatic scenario.
Oh, I love these.
Farragin announces a massive special dividend. Mary sees the press release, and it clearly states that the record date is this Friday. The company is going to take the snapshot on Friday afternoon.
Mary wants that cash, so she wakes up on Friday morning, logs in, and buys 100 shares.
So here's a question for you listening. Does Mary get the dividend?
Just think about the settlement timeline.
No, she completely misses it. Let's follow the T+1 math. Mary buys on Friday. That is the trade date. Because settlement takes one full business day, the trade does not actually settle until Monday.
When Ferrigen checks their master ledger on Friday afternoon, Mary's name is not there. The system hasn't updated yet. The name of the person who sold her the stock is still on the ledger, so the seller gets the dividend check.
Mary bought the stock too late. Because of this one-day delay in settlement, the financial industry established the ex-dividend date. Ex means without.
The ex-dividend date is defined as the very first day the stock trades without the right to receive the upcoming dividend.
Under the new T+1 settlement rules, the ex-dividend date is typically the exact same day as the record date.
If the record date is Friday, the ex-dividend date is Friday. If you buy the stock on Friday, you are buying it ex-dividend. The seller gets to keep the dividend, and you do not.
Therefore, the absolute golden rule of dividend mechanics is, to receive the dividend, you must execute your trade before the ex-dividend date. In Mary's scenario, the absolute latest she could have bought the stock and settled in time was Thursday, buy before the ex-date.
And there's one final, incredibly cool mechanical detail about the ex-date. On the morning of the ex-dividend date, before the market even opens, the stock exchange will automatically intervene and reduce the opening price of the stock by the exact amount of the dividend.
Why? Because the night before, that cash was sitting inside the company, padding its valuation. But on the morning of the ex-date, that cash is legally earmarked to be shipped out the door to the old shareholders.
The value has literally left the building. So if Ferrigen closed at $100 on Thursday and the dividend is $2, the exchange will artificially force the stock to open at $98 on Friday morning. The market price instantly reflects the cash leaving the corporate treasury.
Okay, before we move away from dividends, I want to introduce a concept that fundamentally changes the power dynamic between the board of directors and the investors.
We established that the board has the absolute right to withhold dividends. But what if they abuse that power?
Imagine Frank, the founder, gets greedy. He decides he wants to starve out the preferred stockholders. He skips paying the preferred dividend in year one. He skips it in year two. He skips it in year three. He just hoards the cash inside the company.
What happens to those preferred investors? Do they have any recourse?
It depends entirely on the specific legal phrasing of their preferred stock contract. The exam breaks this down into three distinct categories. The first is non-cumulative preferred.
If you own non-cumulative preferred and the board skips a dividend, you are completely out of luck. That dividend is vaporized.
It does not carry over to the next year. The board effectively says, sorry, we needed the cash. Maybe we'll pay you next year. You have zero leverage.
The second type is participating preferred. This is a unique hybrid instrument. Participating preferred gives the investor their stated fixed dividend percentage, but it also contains a kicker clause.
If the company has a spectacularly profitable year and they blow past their internal targets, the participating preferred stockholders actually get to re-enter the line and share in the excess profits alongside the common stockholders.
They get the safety of the fixed dividend plus a bonus slice of the common upside.
But the third type is the most critical for the exam, and it is the ultimate defense mechanism against a hostile board, cumulative preferred.
If you own cumulative preferred stock, the board can still choose to skip your dividend, but the money does not vaporize. Instead, every single skipped payment accumulates on a legal ledger as what is called an arrearage.
Think of arrearages as a massive compounding toll booth being built on the highway to the company's treasury.
Let's play out Frank's starvation tactic. He skips the cumulative preferred dividend in year one. He skips year two. He skips year three. The arrearages are piling up.
Then, in year four, Ferrigen cures a major disease. The company makes $1 billion in pure profit. Frank decides he wants to reward himself and corporate Carl because they own millions of shares of common stock. Frank proposes a massive record-breaking cash dividend for the common shareholders.
Can he do it? Absolutely not. The toll booth drops.
Corporate law dictates that a board cannot pay a single penny of dividends to the common stockholders until they reach backward and completely satisfy every single arrearage owed to the cumulative preferred stockholders.
Frank has to pay the missed year one dividend, then the missed year two dividend, then the missed year three dividend, and he has to pay the current year four preferred dividend.
Only after that entire cumulative ledger is wiped clean to zero are the common stockholders legally allowed to touch the profits.
This mechanism is brilliant because it removes the incentive for the board to starve the preferred investors. If the board ever wants to enrich themselves via their common stock holdings, they have to pay the preferred investors first. The arrearage rule forces the board to behave.
All right, take a breath. We have covered the residual voting rights, the heavy SEC regulations of the secondary market, and the complex plumbing of dividend distribution.
It's a lot, but you're doing great.
For our final major deep dive in Section 4, we are moving into the mechanics of corporate compensation, employee stock options. Getting a slice for working there.
Let's set the narrative. Ferrigen is expanding exponentially. Frank, the founder, needs to recruit the absolute best talent on the planet.
He finds a world-renowned genius geneticist working at a massive university. Frank wants to hire her as a full-time W-2 employee to run his new lab.
He also needs to rebrand the company for the public markets, so he contracts a brilliant, high-priced, independent marketing consultant.
Ferrigen is a biotech startup. They are burning cash on lab equipment. Frank doesn't have the liquid capital to pay the geneticist a $2 million cash salary.
So he utilizes the ultimate startup weapon, stock options. He offers to supplement their lower cash salaries by giving them a piece of the future upside.
Before we dive into the brutal tax consequences of these instruments, we have to define the basic architecture of a stock option.
An employee stock option is fundamentally a contract. It grants the worker the legal right, but not the obligation, to purchase a specific number of shares of the company's stock at a locked-in, predetermined price at some point in the future.
That locked-in price is known as the exercise price or the strike price.
Let's say Frank hands the geneticist an option contract that says, because you work here, you have the right to buy 10,000 shares of Ferrigen stock at an exercise price of $10 a share.
Fast forward 5 years. The geneticist has revolutionized the field. Ferrigen goes public, and the stock is trading on the open market at $100 a share. This is the fair market value.
The geneticist can now execute her contract. She hands Frank $10. Frank hands her a share of stock that is intrinsically worth $100.
The mathematical difference between the $100 fair market value and her $10 locked-in exercise price is called the spread, or on the exam, you will frequently see it called the bargain element.
In this scenario, she has a $90 per share spread. That is pure, unadulterated wealth creation.
But as you know, whenever massive wealth is created, the IRS immediately steps into the room.
They always find out.
How that $90 spread is taxed depends entirely on the specific legal classification of the option Frank granted. We are going to run a side-by-side showdown of the two dominant types of options.
Incentive stock options, or ISOs, versus non-qualified stock options, NQSOs.
Let's start with a massive, immediate exam trap regarding eligibility. Who is legally allowed to receive these different options? Think back to our two recruits, the full-time geneticist and the independent marketing consultant.
The exam will attempt to trick you by suggesting that the company awards an incentive stock option, an ISO, to the independent consultant.
That is a violation of federal tax law. Incentive stock options are an exclusive statutory benefit created by Congress specifically to reward dedicated corporate employees.
By law, an ISO can only be granted to a direct W-2 employee of the issuing corporation.
You cannot give an ISO to an independent contractor. You cannot give an ISO to an outside consultant. You cannot even give an ISO to a non-employee member of the board of directors.
So by default, the full-time geneticist receives the highly coveted ISO. The independent marketing consultant receives the standard non-qualified stock option.
Because ISOs offer profound tax advantages to the employee, the IRS builds a fence of strict limitations around them to prevent abuse. Let's look at the rules surrounding the strike price.
For the geneticist's ISO to be valid, the law dictates that the exercise price must be set at or above the actual fair market value of the stock on the exact day the option is granted.
Frank cannot give the geneticist an option that is already in the money. If the stock is worth $10 today, the strike price must be at least $10. She only profits if she actually helps grow the value of the company moving forward.
Non-qualified options have no such restriction. Frank can legally hand the consultant an NQSO with a strike price of a penny, giving them instant built-in value.
The second major rule is the vesting limit. The IRS places a strict cap on how much ISO wealth can unlock in a single year. Specifically, there is a $100,000 annual vesting limit.
Frank can give the geneticist $1 million worth of options on her first day, but only $100,000 worth of that stock is allowed to become exercisable in any given calendar year.
What happens to the excess? If $150,000 worth of options magically vests in a single year, the IRS doesn't confiscate the extra $50,000. It simply strips away the incentive status. That excess $50,000 automatically degrades into a standard non-qualified option.
And finally, ISOs have a maximum statutory lifespan of 10 years. You must exercise them within a decade or they evaporate. NQSOs have no legally mandated expiration, though companies typically set their own internal deadlines.
Okay, we have defined the boundaries. Now we step into the most heavily tested, complex part of this entire section, the tax treatment timeline.
To understand how the IRS extracts its toll, we have to look at the three distinct chronological events in the life of an option: the grant, the exercise, and the sale.
Event one is the grant. This is the day Frank sits across the desk, slides the contract over, and both the geneticist and the consultant sign their paperwork. What is the tax liability on this day?
Zero. The IRS does not tax you for simply receiving a piece of paper that says, maybe, if things go well, you might be allowed to buy stock in the future.
There is no realized economic value on the grant date for either an ISO or an NQSO.
Event two is the exercise. Fast forward 5 years. The stock has rocketed to $100 a share. Both the geneticist and the consultant decide to pull the trigger.
They write checks to Farragen at their $10 strike price, and they both acquire shares worth $100. They have both captured that massive $90 spread. Let's look at the consultant's non-qualified option first, because it is brutally straightforward.
When you exercise an NQSO, the IRS treats that $90 spread as if Frank literally opened a briefcase and handed the consultant cash. It is taxed immediately on the day of exercise as ordinary income.
It does not matter that the consultant hasn't actually sold the stock yet. The IRS views the spread as realized compensation. It hits their W-2 or 1099, and they owe their highest marginal income tax rate on that $90 per share immediately.
This creates a massive liquidity problem for people with NQSOs because they owe huge cash tax bills on paper stock profits they haven't even liquidated yet.
Now, let's look at the geneticist's incentive stock option. This is the magic of the ISO. When the geneticist exercises her option and captures that $90 spread, she owes absolutely zero regular income tax on that day.
Let me repeat that. At the point of exercise, there is no regular ordinary income tax triggered by an ISO spread.
But this is the IRS we're dealing with. There is always a shadow mechanism. While the geneticist avoids regular income tax, that $90 spread is officially classified as an alternative minimum tax, or AMT preference item.
We need to explain what the AMT actually is, because if you understand the why, you won't have to blindly memorize the rule. Back in 1969, the Secretary of the Treasury testified before Congress and revealed a scandalous statistic.
155 ultra-high net worth Americans had utilized so many legal deductions, loopholes, and paper wealth mechanisms that they paid absolutely zero federal income tax. The public was outraged.
In response, Congress essentially created a parallel shadow tax universe called the alternative minimum tax.
The AMT is a secondary tax code with completely different rules. It rips away all your favorite deductions, and it specifically targets paper wealth that hasn't been taxed yet, like the massive untaxed spread of an incentive stock option.
So when the geneticist exercises her ISO, she has to hire an accountant to calculate her taxes twice. First, under the normal rules. Then she calculates her taxes again under the AMT shadow rules, which brutally adds that $90 per share spread back into her taxable income.
The IRS then looks at both tax bills and forces her to pay whichever one is higher. So while an ISO protects you from regular income tax at exercise, it often drags highly compensated employees straight into the teeth of the AMT.
Now let's look at this from the other side of the desk. Let's look at Frank, the founder.
I have a direct question for you listening. Think about the corporate mechanics here. When an employee exercises a stock option and captures a massive spread, does the corporation get to claim a tax deduction?
Pause for a second.
The answer is, it depends entirely on the type of option. Because the IRS taxes the consultant's NQSO spread immediately as ordinary income, they allow the corporation to treat it as a direct compensation expense.
Farragen gets to claim a massive corporate tax deduction that perfectly matches the income recognized by the consultant.
This is an incredible corporate finance strategy. Frank gets to hand out stock, which doesn't cost him cash, but the company gets to claim a multi-million dollar tax deduction against its revenues. This is exactly why boards of directors actually prefer issuing non-qualified options.
But what about the geneticist's ISO? Because the geneticist doesn't recognize regular ordinary income at exercise, Farragen gets absolutely no corporate tax deduction.
The company receives zero tax benefit when an employee exercises an incentive stock option.
Okay, let's move to event three, the sale. Both individuals have held the stock for a few years. The stock prices continue to climb to $150 a share. They both decide to sell in the open market.
For the consultant with the NQSO, the math is simple. They already paid ordinary income tax on the spread up to $100. So their new cost basis is $100. When they sell at $150, they simply pay standard capital gains tax on that final $50 of growth, depending on how long they held it.
But the geneticist with the ISO is playing for the ultimate prize. The entire purpose of enduring the AMT and jumping through the ISO hoops is the potential to have the entire massive game, from the original $10 strike price all the way up to the $150 sale price, taxed at the highly favorable low long-term capital gains rate.
To unlock that ultimate tax windfall, the geneticist must achieve what the IRS calls a qualifying disposition. She must satisfy two overlapping, rigid holding periods.
First, she must hold the physical shares for at least one full year after the date she exercised the option.
Second, the date of the final sale must be at least two full years after the original grant date of the option contract.
1 year from exercise and the 2 years from grant. She must cross both finish lines.
Why did Congress build these specific delays? Because they wanted to explicitly prevent pump and dump behavior. They wanted executives to tie their personal net worth to the long-term, multi-year survival of the corporation, not just pump the stock price for a quick tax-advantaged exit.
What happens if the geneticist gets impatient? What if she exercises the option and then immediately sells the stock 6 months later to buy a mansion?
That triggers a disqualifying disposition. The magic shield of the ISO shatters. The IRS retroactively treats the original spread exactly as if it were a non-qualified option.
The geneticist is slammed with ordinary income tax rates on the initial gain, destroying the entire tax advantage of the instrument.
If I can summarize this entire options matrix for you, ISOs reward deep patience. If the employee can navigate the complexities of the AMT and hold the stock long enough to satisfy the 1 year and 2 year rules, it generates a massive, life-changing tax windfall for the employee. But it offers zero tax benefit to the issuing company.
And NQSOs are painful for the employee because they are taxed immediately at high ordinary income rates upon exercise. But they are a phenomenal tool for the corporation because they generate massive non-cash tax deductions.
All right. Take a very deep breath. We have systematically dismantled the architecture of equity ownership. We have navigated the proxy battles of voting rights, the heavy hand of SEC resale restrictions, the delayed settlement plumbing of dividends, and the treacherous tax labyrinth of corporate options.
It is time to crystallize this. Let's run a rapid-fire recap of the absolute most critical, highly testable mechanisms we covered today.
Statutory versus cumulative voting, remember the tug of war. Statutory isolates the elections, guaranteeing the majority wins every seat. Cumulative allows the pooling of votes, serving as a defensive weapon to guarantee the minority shareholder gets a voice in the room.
Liquidation priority. The mountain collapses from the top down. Secured debt, unsecured debt, subordinated debt, preferred stock. And standing dead last at the peak, holding the ultimate residual risk and getting paid absolute last, is the common stock.
Rule 144 holding periods. The SEC demands sunlight. If the company files public reports, the insider is locked up for 6 months. If it is a non-reporting black box, the lockup is 12 months.
And remember the volume limits. Insiders are permanently capped at selling the greater of 1% outstanding or the four-week average to prevent market panic. But non-affiliates, once their holding period is up, they can sell everything instantly with zero restrictions.
Form 4. Remember the Enron executives hiding in the shadows. To prevent information asymmetry, insiders must report any change in their ownership within exactly 2 business days. It is about speed, not size. 1 share triggers the 2-day clock.
Stock dividends. Remember the island printing more paper money to chase the same amount of gold or the pizza being cut into more slices? A stock dividend does not create wealth. It just dilutes the share price. Therefore, it is not a taxable event. It merely lowers your cost basis per share.
Dividend timelines. T plus one settlement means a stock trade takes 1 business day to clear the DTCC. Because of that delay, you must buy the stock before the ex-dividend date to get your name on the record books in time to claim the cash.
Cumulative preferred stock. It is the ultimate toll booth. If a board starves the preferred investors, those missed dividends become arrearages. Every single arrearage must be paid in full before the common stockholders can touch a single penny of the profits.
And finally, employee stock options. ISOs are exclusively for W-2 employees. They trigger the AMT at exercise, and to unlock long-term capital gains, the employee must hold the stock for 2 years from the grant date and 1 year from the exercise date.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a completely different lens through which to view your own portfolio.
We've spent an hour talking about the intricate, sometimes brutal legal architecture of controlling pieces of a company. Frank, Mary, Carl, the SEC rules, the IRS shadows.
Consider this. When you pull out your phone, open your brokerage app, and click buy on a stock ticker, the interface makes it feel like a frictionless video game. The number flashes green or it flashes red. You swipe up and it's done.
But you aren't just trading a digital symbol on a glowing screen. In that exact microsecond, when that trade hits the clearinghouse, you are instantly adopting a complex, centuries-old bundle of historical legal rights, restrictions, and liabilities.
You are legally slotting yourself into a highly specific place in a corporate hierarchy. You are taking on residual risk. You are subjecting yourself to board decisions. You are entering a legal battleground.
The next time you look at a portfolio, whether it is your own retirement account or you are advising a client, look past the flashing ticker symbols. Ask yourself, do you truly understand the legal puzzle pieces you are actually holding in your hands?
Keep reviewing these mechanisms. Look at the why behind the rules, and the memorization will take care of itself.
Keep running through those practice questions and trust the process. You are putting in the deep work, and it is going to pay off when you sit down for the exam. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you on the next deep dive.